for our third session in the series. We're going to move on to talk about the forgery, but I will stay on after the session is over. So keep your questions, write them down, whatever, and we'll talk about it when after 11 o'clock. I will stick around, but I want to get to the forgery discussion as well, because this is really bizarre. What we're going to see here is a maskil, a thinker within the Jewish Enlightenment, who is going to choose to attribute his liberal positions to a leading rabbi of the past. And you might be surprised by this. And you might ask, how could somebody who prides himself on intellectual exploration and debate be so dishonest? But there are two reasons why. Number one, the Haskalah involved, the Enlightenment involved a very, very bitter battle between its proponents and the antagonists. We don't have time now to have a full discussion about where the Haskalah came from. Suffice to say that it is very much a product of the general Enlightenment in Europe. The liberalization of policies about Jews attending university, the growth in the movement for emancipation in Europe at the end of the 18th century, it is not the same thing as the Reform Movement. It's important to distinguish between the two. I may come back to that later. The two are entirely different things. Reform is not a product of the Enlightenment. It's a different entity. People often confuse them. But I want to show you just how intense the battle over the Haskalah, over the Enlightenment was. Take a look on your sheet, please, at source number 14, and you'll see what I mean. And I'm adding, again, the link to the sheet in the chat. In source number 14, from David Friedlander, from the time of... David Friedlander is himself an Enlightenment figure. From that time, if you look at the source I gave you here, The Jew in the Modern World, it's a very worthwhile text. It's got primary source material from that era that's really useful. So listen to this quote from an Enlightenment thinker. "We are living among the Gentiles, all of whom daily probe into their religions in order to eliminate the chaff, to purify their morals and to improve their faith. We, on the other hand, who have started out on the highest level, constantly deteriorate. Were our rabbis not completely blind? Were they not confined to the four walls of the halakha, Jewish law? Were they know as much about the things of the world as I know about the doings of the Nabob in Sanghar? They would think of repairing the breach, but nobody seems to notice." So his belief is, the rabbis are all living in the Dark Ages. They used to be ahead of everybody in philosophy, and now they are unenlightened and foolish and unaware of the ways of the world. That's one side. Now look at the other side. A response. Rabbi David ben Natan of Lisa. And he said, it's not a response to Friedlander. You can see the years I gave you. He's writing 10 years earlier. But look at the rabbinic approach to this. He's talking about Naftali Hertz Wesley, who was an Enlightenment thinker. And he says, "We speak of an act by a sycophant, an evil man, a man poor in understanding, the most mediocre of men. This man, Hertz Wesley of Berlin, has addressed an epistle to those of the House of Israel who dwell in the land of His Majesty the Emperor. This epistle, called Words of Peace and Truth, Divrei Shalom Ve'emet, makes one's heart heavy. It consists of 8 chapters of bootlicking. And deeming himself unique in his generation, he offers rash advice to wise, understanding, perfect, and flawless men." So neither side likes the other. This is a very intense battle. But it's not just that. There's an important word to know about. The word is pseudepigraphy. And what it means and is essentially the idea of a Yeah, I'm going to put it in the chat. I mean, it's basically the way it sounds. Whoops, missed the letter. My letter R is not working on my keyboard. There it goes. Okay, now it's in the chat. It's what it sounds like. Pseudo, right? False. Epigraphy. What is epigraphy? So what it means is attributing your ideas to somebody else. Claiming that it's reverse plagiarism. right? Instead of claiming that you wrote somebody else's ideas, you're claiming that somebody wrote the idea that you came up with. Why would you do that? Why would you want to do that?
To give it credibility.
Yeah, to give it credibility. You want to gain authority. You want your idea to gain currency. And in truth, there is some difference of opinion in Jewish tradition about when this might be appropriate. On the one hand, we're told, you should always say things in the name of the person who said them. We're taught that regarding Esther and Mordechai, how Esther reports to Ahasuerus that Mordechai has saved his life, right? And that ends up leading to Mordechai being in a parade and being honored, and in some way intersects with Haman's story that's beyond the scope of our discussion right now. But we are told, look at that, Esther reported in the name of Mordechai. You should always say things in the name of those who said them. And in source number 17, we find the Talmud talking about, the Jerusalem Talmud, talking about a controversial statement that was attributed to Rabbi Yochanan. And the argument was, it was falsely attributed to Rabbi Yochanan. And Rabbi Yochanan says, absolutely not. Of course it was from Rabbi Yochanan. He says, I would never make that up. I would never lie about this. He says, of course Rabbi Yochanan was the author. I would never falsely attribute something to somebody else. So it sounds like you're not allowed to attribute your statements to somebody else just to gain authority. However, if you flip the page... If you look at source number 18, you find the interesting recommendation. If you wish to be strangled, hang yourself by a tall tree. What that means in context is, in the Hebrew, for those who the Hebrew is, hitalev ve'ilan gadol. What it's saying is that if you want people to believe what you say, say that it came from a great authority. Suggesting that it's okay, it's even advisable for you to claim that a great figure said your opinion. So there's a lot to be discussed in terms of the place of pseudepigraphy in Jewish tradition. But that may be an influence on the decision of the Enlightenment thinker to do what we're about to learn about. Okay, so we're clear? The two factors that drive this are the intensity of the fight involved in the Enlightenment, and number two, this the question of whether you're able to attribute your writing to somebody else. But let's get into the story. The Haskalah was, as I said, inspired by the secular Enlightenment. It's marked by a drive for secular learning and involvement in broader society. It starts in Western Europe and then sweeps from west to east. So it starts in Germany and ends ultimately in the Ukraine and in Russia. It was led by scholars who were themselves educated in Torah, but they wanted to liberalize it. And as I said before, it's not really the antecedent for reform. The fundamental difference between the Haskalah and reform is that the Haskalah argued that Jewish law and Jewish tradition really agrees with them. Whereas Reform said, it's time to change tradition. Tradition wouldn't agree with what I'm saying, but that's okay, it's time to change it. It's time to drop, you know, X or Y or whatever it is. I'm talking early Reform. This is, you know, what the denominations and movements have become over time is its own mini-series or full series, not something that we're going to do in 5 seconds here. But Haskalah was an argument of, if Rashi were alive today, if Maimonides were alive today, they would say what we say. That was their argument. Okay. One more preface that's necessary in order to understand this. The Rush, also known as Rabbeinu Asher. I put his name in the heading in source number 19. Rabbeinu Asher was a very, very important author of Jewish law, going back to the end of the 13th century, beginning of the 14th century. He was very important. First of all, he was extremely prolific in his responsa. He wrote a ton. He also created one of those legal codes I mentioned before, where he took the passages from the Talmud that were relevant to Jewish law and brought them together with his comments as a sort of code of Jewish law. But most important is that he was a bridge between Ashkenaz and Sfard. He was born in Germany, grew up and became a rabbinic authority in Germany, and then he fled persecution in Germany in 1303 and went to Spain, where he became a leading authority there. So that he bridges Ashkenaz and Sfard. And that's really, really important, because now, you're now in this story, almost 500 years after his time, you want to create a work of law that is liberal. You know what you do? You say, Rabbeinu Asher, the Rosh, he was the one who wrote this work of law, not me. And that way it will be accepted by Ashkenazim and by Sfardim. Incidentally, another reason he's very important, it's not incidental, it's actually very germane, is that Rabbeinu Asher had a son, Rabbi Yaakov ben Asher, who wrote a work of law called the Tur, which ultimately led to the Shulchan Aruch, to the code of Jewish law. So it's not only about Rabbeinu Asher himself, but his influence is heavy in the creation of the next generation of codes of law. So if you know, we said before, hang yourself by a tall tree. The author of this forgery picks the tallest tree he can find. Right? Short of Maimonides, basically. And this is what happens. In the year 1793, a book appears called Besamim Rosh. Besamim Rosh literally is a term for spices. It's found in the Torah. But it's actually a play on words. Besamim, as a Hebrew word, has a gematria, a numerical value, if you know the value of each letter in the gematria system, of 392. And there are 392 responsa in this work of law. It's 392 answers to questions of Jewish law. So it's 392 of the Rosh, of Rabbeinu Asher. Are we clear on that? Is everyone following? I know I'm going quickly here. We're good? I'm not looking at all the screens. I'm only seeing the first screen. I should really be scrolling more so I can see, because we've got 113 screens on here. But hopefully this is okay. And for those whose screens are not visible, I can't see anyway. So in any case, Rabbeinu Asher is this giant of Jewish law. His name is condensed or contracted to Rosh, and this forgery is a printing, allegedly, of 392 responsa of his. It was published by a man named Rabbi Shaul Berlin. His father was the head of the rabbinical court in Berlin. So Rabbi Shaul Berlin claimed that he had found this work. It had been compiled by Rabbi Yitzchak di Molina, a sage in Italy. And he said it was found in an obscure library, but you can't get the original manuscript from way back when. Only the copy that I made of what was found in that obscure library. And Rabbi Berlin says, I am publishing this along with my little commentary. He calls his commentary Kasa Deharsana, which means a cup of fish. And it's a term used in the Talmud as the most minimal thing that a pauper should have to make Shabbos different from the rest of the week. Have a little herring, essentially. So he calls his commentary herring, more or less. And it's a self-deprecating statement, presumably. Yeah.
Is this 392 responses to the Haskalah?
So these are 392 responses that he's alleging were written in the end of the 13th century, beginning of the 14th century, by Rabbeinu Asher. And
what?
Hang on, we'll get there. So there are accusations of fraud right away. Pamphlets are published against this thing. But the work was solid. Because if you read the work in the original Hebrew, and you can find it if you go to hebrewbooks.org, I didn't include a link for it. Maybe I'll include it when I send the follow-up email later today. But but you can find it online if you have the Hebrew skills for it. The writing is similar to the style of rabbis from the time of the Rush. There's a little poetry in it. There are responses that are shorter, some that are longer. And because of the printing press, it spreads quickly before it can be proven to be a forgery. Now, why was it suspect? Works came to light like this. This was found in an obscure library somewhere. So the answer is, number one, because Shaul Berlin himself, despite his father's status as the head of the rabbinical court in Berlin, was known as a maskil, somebody who fancied himself as enlightened, and he wanted to introduce change in the way people practice Jewish law. He had written an anonymous attack on somebody else's work of law. So when he comes forward saying, hey, isn't that neat? I found this old manuscript from Rabbeinu Asher. People are looking at him like, really? What's your interest in Jewish law? Why would you want to produce something like that? That's number one. Number two, sometimes the opinions that are presented in this work don't have any sources. And Rabbeinu Asher's style was to present sources. So that's a second reason. But the third reason, and the most interesting one, because it highlights what he was trying to do, is that some of the opinions presented there are just too unlikely to be those of Rabbeinu Asher. I brought you some translations that I did on the sheet so you could get a sense of this. Look in source number 19. This is a bona fide responsum of Rabbeinu Asher regarding studying secular philosophy. He says, the wisdom of philosophy and the wisdom of Torah and its laws do not follow the same path. The wisdom of Torah is a tradition received by Moses from Sinai. The scholar will analyze it via the methods assigned for its analysis, comparing one matter and another. Even where this doesn't match natural wisdom, we follow tradition. Philosophical wisdom is natural, with great scholars who establish natural arguments, and in their great wisdom they dug deeper and they corrupted, and needed to deny the Torah of Moses. The Torah is entirely unnatural and revelatory. He says, revelation, not reason. I'm not interested in philosophy. And you can see more of that there in source number 19. Jump to source 21, please. 20 is also good for this, but 21 is even more clear. This is a responsum in Besamim Rosh to someone who allegedly had asked about whether they should learn philosophy. And look at this. He's putting these words in the mouth of Rabbeinu Asher. It is known to most, and to almost all students, one cannot learn wisdom in such matters unless he fills his belly with Greek texts, engaging in deep analysis of their compositions. And even though these are the beginning of Torah and the essence of religion, still all agree that one cannot grasp the essence of Torah and mitzvah from the intellect he acquires from simple scripture and the words of our sages of blessed memory, but via the intellect that learns and is accustomed to the works of the philosophers of the nations. He says you need to learn philosophy or you won't understand Torah. The opposite of Rabbeinu Asher in source number 19, who said these are different systems altogether. That's one example of what he does here. Another example, he was very lenient about riding a horse on Shabbat, which was a major issue for people who wanted to blend into non-Jewish society. He's permissive regarding having a non-Jewish barber shave a Jew using a razor. You know, biblically, a Jew is not supposed to shave their face, a Jewish man is not supposed to shave their face with a razor. However, he says you could have a non-Jewish barber do it for you. He says that's all right. And he says, on Chol HaMoed, parts of the Jewish holidays, you could be lenient about shaving as well. And I brought that for you in source number 22. Shaving was a major, major issue for them as well, because getting rid of the beard and being clean shaven allowed you to travel among the intellectuals of Europe of that time. But perhaps the most glaring is the last source I brought you on the sheet, in source number 23. He says, look at this, God gave Jews the Torah to bring them to satisfaction and completion, to goodness and pleasure. Therefore, occasionally when we have sinned and warped our paths, some of the Torah's laws have damaged the good which should have come upon us via fulfillment of the Torah. So the laws have themselves become harmful. And then we have rejected that law and done the opposite. Meaning sometimes you have to reject the law of the Torah. Sometimes the law is no longer good for you. And he quotes you a verse from Psalms, it is a time to act for God because they have nullified your Torah, which is a verse that's actually used in the Talmud to justify certain changes. He's not making it up wholesale. But he says, if it could be imagined that a time might come when the laws and mitzvot of the Torah might clearly bring evil upon our nation, the whole nation, or if even it could be imagined they would not bring satisfaction to the nation, we would throw its yoke from upon our necks. The hinge upon which all of the Torah's laws turn is that God instructed the Jews to perform these laws out of love, for he desires kindness and he spoke good for Israel. He says, it could change. It's supposed to change. Not everything in this work was leniency. Not everything in this work was change. There's a lot of it that's actually very solid scholarship. Enough so that there were rabbis who actually bought into it. And there are still rabbis to this day who will not reject this work B'Samim Rosh and who think that, you know, it could still be the work of the Rosh. However, the nail in the coffin was that one of Shaul Berlin's friends had a copy of one of Berlin's anonymous works with a note in the margin saying, this is written by Berlin who also wrote B'Samim Rosh. That's always bad. Never sign your name to your notes. It's a bad practice. But that's the story in a nutshell of this B'Samim Rosh. It was an attempt to try to backdate Enlightenment to a leading figure in the development of Jewish law. And again, it comes from the bitter battle between the two sides, as well as the question about pseudepigraphy, and Irv Salat wrote a note in the chat that's important to recognize. The Zohar, he says, may be an example of exactly this. We credit the Zohar to Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. There's a lot of debate about the authorship of the Zohar. The view that I understand and accept is that Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai wrote the core of what became the Zohar, but layers have been added over time. And everyone just sort of lumps it together and says it's all Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, which certainly does give it greater authority. But the point that I'm trying to make here is just this fascinating development in publishing. I had more examples of forgeries. Maybe someday we'll get to come back to it. But as I said to you in the beginning, I'm going to stay on now for questions, comments, discussion from either the previous topic that we did or this one. I apologize for just monologuing basically for an hour and 3 minutes. That's not the style I prefer. But nonetheless, hopefully it worked for you. And when I send out the follow-up email later today, I also expect to send out the new flyer with the Wednesday classes, which begin, God willing, on Wednesday, September 2nd, if that's a Wednesday. Is that a Wednesday? Yes, it is. Wednesday, September 2nd, we'll be talking about the socially distanced high holidays. So that'll be September 2nd and 9th, and then we proceed from there, God willing, through the year. Thank you so much for participating. Those who need to go, I'm certainly not insulted, but those who can stay on and have questions, please do. Yes, Claudette.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Questions, comments?
Thank you, Rabbi.
Thank you.
Can I ask a question, please? Can we go back to number 15?
Yes.
Where he talks about Hertz Westerly of Berlin? Like, what's all that about?
So Naftali Hertz Westerly was one of the major figures of the Enlightenment. He wrote very strongly and powerfully against the rabbinic establishment in Germany. I'm actually looking on my computer while I'm answering you. I had a file here where I translated some of Wesley's writings. I just didn't include it here because of space issues. But I want to see if I can call it up on my computer and quote it for you. But he was one of the major figures in the Enlightenment in Germany. Hang on. Yes, I think I have a quote from him here. He He published a work which was called Divrei Shalom Ve'emet, which we referenced there in that in that quote. But here it's opening up on my screen. It's going to take a second to
sure.
Yeah. So, thank you. Okay, so here we go. Wesley was involved in, first of all, he was involved with Moses Mendelssohn when he wrote his German translation, the Biur, of the Chumash, of the biblical text. So, he was an assistant, interestingly, for part of that work. But that's not... Yeah, that's not what I was looking for. Ah, there it is. Hang on. Yes. So he writes the following. This is from his Divrei Shalom Ve'emet, his words of peace and truth. Now, in order to educate the youths of Israel in the proper manner, two types of studies should be established. The first type is the study of human knowledge, that is, those matters which earn for their possessors the title man, since he who lacks this knowledge hardly deserves this title, as shall be explained. The second type is the study of the Torah of God, that is, God's laws and teachings, matters that are above human reason and that were made known to Moses through prophetic revelation. So, he doesn't disagree that there is a... a pedigree for Torah, but his belief is if you don't have knowledge of what he calls human knowledge here, you're not even a human being. And what I excerpted there was kind of one of the nicer types of things that he had to say. I also want to answer a question that someone sent me in the chat. How did his father, Schoberlin's father, react to his son's forgery? So that's actually a very interesting question. And I want to thank people for their comments in the chat, the private ones as well as the public ones. I just can't respond to each one right now. But his father didn't know about the nature of his son. His father was either unaware entirely or in denial. So that when Berlin wrote his earlier work, which had bashed a work of Jewish law, he did it anonymously, and his father came out and wrote harshly against that response to the Jewish law that his son had written, not knowing it was his son's work. If you look at the Besamim Rosh, the edition I'm going to give you on Hebrew books, so in the link that I expect to put in the email later, so he actually wrote the introduction to Besamim Rosh. And he mentions his son's commentary. He's completely unaware of what his son is doing in this regard. I don't know if he ever finds out. Meaning he's alive to know about the accusation that it's a forgery, but it was controversial. So I don't know if he ever accepted that had actually happened. I would be kind of surprised, but I don't know. Other questions and comments? Nope. Okay, well then, thank you very, very much. And it's great to see you. Phyllis, blast from the past.
So good to see you. Hang on one second. Let me just enlarge my window.